for today, Bradford Manufacturing versus Smith Systems. Mr. Unical.
Please the court, Alan Unical and my partner Bart Lazar on behalf of Bradford Manufacturing. The district court originally found reverse passing off here under the Lanham Act and state law and awarded Bradford compensatory damages, prejudgment interest, and attorney's fees. Then on a motion for reconsideration, the district court relied on the Supreme Court's decision in Daystar to reverse itself. We contend that the district court was wrong in doing so. Daystar does not support a reversal of the prior decision. Also, the district court improperly awarded summary judgment on Bradford's trade dress claim when clearly the court made an error really of law in terms of making the likelihood of confusion determination. But I think it's pretty clear that the main thing we're here about is the reverse passing off claim. And if you look at the judge's decision, there are really two points that he made. One, that a sample of a good cannot be goods under Section 43A. And we think that is clearly wrong. Secondly, that whatever part of the Bradford table was used, whether it's a component or even a substantial part of it, that unless it was the complete table, that could not be passing off under the Lanham Act. And both of those points are clearly wrong. Now, I want to get to Daystar, but I'd like to just point out both of these issues rely on the question of what is reverse passing off. At page 36 of our brief, we cite Coleman, and I think...
Does this phrase help you?
Pardon?
Does this phrase help you? Reverse passing off. The legal question in this case, as I see it, is whether you can incorporate into your product goods made by somebody else without violating the Lanham Act. So let's take other examples. Suppose somebody buys a Ford car, takes off the body shell, and then puts on a creative new shell. That's actually what John DeLorean did to make the DeLorean car. So it's got a Ford engine and a drivetrain in it. It's got a DeLorean fiberglass shell, and DeLorean sells it and calls it a DeLorean car. Has that violated Ford's rights under federal law?
Most likely it does. And let me explain why.
Well, if that's correct, you are essentially destroying all commerce because you will want to hear the rest of the question. This
sure.
is not The Price is Right. You don't get any bonus for pressing the buzzer early. Almost all products are made using goods from somebody else. Very few people cut down the trees themselves, mill the steel, and so on. They incorporate other people's goods into their own. That's how products are made. If, in your view, that violates the Lanham Act, you have disintegrated almost all business in the United States. So it can't be right. There must be some other limiting principle here.
Well, I think the limiting principle is the presumption that, first of all, in the example you give, a substantial part of the automobile is obtained from a competitor. Now, the presumption that only makes this sensible is that does that competitor, does the party that incorporates a competitor's product or parts of the product, can they go forward and do they have the present ability to make that car with those parts? In these cases...
I don't understand.
In other words, will DeLorean continue to be able to buy from Ford the material that
DeLorean
he's...
DeLorean may do that for the first year to see if it works... It may not.
The presumption is that Ford is willing to sell them. This is the whole point. You're going to go to
a
competitor.
Look, you don't buy Ford cars from Ford. You buy Ford cars in the market from independent dealers, doubtless protected under some Wisconsin statute, or you buy them from secondhand dealers.
Ford
actually was sued under the antitrust laws for refusing to sell drivetrains to DeLorean. But DeLorean proved to be quite capable of buying Ford parts without having to deal with Ford.
And that's the problem, Your Honor. In the reverse passing off cases, it's a matter of getting a head start. It's if you can buy a component from your competitor and use it in your car, That's one thing. But there's no evidence, even in this case, that Bradford was willing to sell components of its tables.
Who cares? Bradford tables are for sale in the aftermarket. The rule against restraints on alienation doesn't enable Bradford to stop its customers from reselling its legs to anybody else.
But that's not what happens.
I don't see why it matters where the leg came from. The legal issue is whether it is a violation of the trademark law to incorporate a part of somebody else's product into your product. That is, to make a product without having made every single component yourself. And that's what we're trying to focus
on. And in these cases, each of these cases, when someone says that it has taken a part or a substantial part of a competitor's product, it involves an express or implied representation that the defendant is presently able to produce the product identical to the plaintiff's when it can't. And that's really the issue. In other words,
Now you've gone completely off the deep end. Now you're saying that every time anybody sells a product with a component from somebody else, they must be violating federal law because they're implying that they could make the component themselves. And that would make essentially every product sold in the United States a violation of federal law all the time.
I think not, Your Honor. We're just talking about a head start. It may be true that Smith at some point...
Most manufacturers never, ever come to make all the component parts. I mean, look at this computer. It's got a screen from LG Electronics, a hard drive from IBM, memory from Toshiba. Right? The manufacturer of this computer is never going to make its memory modules. That's not how the business is done. It incorporates things made by other people. And it's not representing that it's going to have the ability to make the memory modules in a month. It will never make the memory modules.
That's the point, Your Honor, on a commercial. I'm not saying that the manufacturer has to make all the components itself, but the manufacturer, when it presents a sample to the public, has to be able to obtain product and components so that it could make the product identical to the one that is presenting to the customer. And what is wrong in this case is that this defendant tried to make the components. It did subcontract out to Mr. Fang. It said, Mr. Fang, make this Y-shaped table leg. And he couldn't do it. Now, the commercial reality is they had two choices. Smith could have waited and gone to other manufacturers or waited till Mr. Fong was able to make the part and then in fair dealing and honest competition produce the part. Nobody's saying that they had to make it all themselves.
Did any of Smith's customers complain?
They only had the one customer that they used as part. In a reverse passing off, it usually is one part.
Did any of Smith's customers complain?
No. But
aren't they the people who would be aggrieved, if any, by a supposed inability to make further samples of the product?
They are aggrieved. They are aggrieved.
But if they don't complain...
Because they don't know. They bought a product which they thought, and the implied representation is that the defendant made the product, including, in this case, the Y-shaped legs.
I do not understand it even remotely. When I buy this computer, I do not believe that I have an implied representation that Apple Computer made all the components in it.
If you say
that there is such an implied representation when somebody sells a product, it's fantasy.
I'm saying that
there's no such representation.
They made an implied representation that they can make an identical product. And they can do that by buying it honestly, components from third parties. What happened here is that they bought a component that they could not reproduce in the future. Smith was not going to be able to complete its contract with the DISD.
True, then the customers would complain.
They wouldn't complain because they don't know. It's a disclosure issue.
I take it.
How can a customer...
Look, trying to outshout the judge is just not going to help you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. How could a customer complain if it is presented with a sample where a manufacturer has obtained product from its competitor and not told the customer? The customer has no reason to complain. The fact that the manufacturer is ultimately able to make the product doesn't make it right. What the courts have said is that there are two classes of parties that are affected by the Lanham Act. One is consumers and one is competitors. They get an unlawful head start by not doing it fairly and getting parts that they have to produce themselves or have others produce for them. And by that, in this case, they would not have been able to make the sale to the DISD if they didn't take parts that they couldn't have made. Mr. Fong couldn't have made it unless they got it from Bradford. And the evidence here is that they didn't just take one component from the Bradford table. They took six of the seven. The only thing that they didn't take was the tabletop. And if the issue in this case is two things, customers are entitled to informed decisions. When you go in, Your Honor, to a store and somebody shows you an Apple computer or whatever they show you, and it turns out that they do not have the present ability to make that because they took all the guts of the computer from an Apple computer, and what they really should have told you was, I can't make that now, but I'll make one just like this, and you trust me. And why should consumers be forced to have to trust manufacturers who are not presently able to make a product? I'm not saying that if they could make a contract with Apple and get the computer, that's one thing. But the presumption in these cases is that you're not going to be able to go to competitors, buy their products at retail, then add your own components, and in any way sell the product. Ultimately, what happens in all of these reverse passing off cases is that a sample is given because it's expedient to do so because the manufacturer hasn't had time and hasn't taken the inclination and spent the time and effort to do it himself and has unfairly taken a competitor's product to make the sale and then over a period of time develops the capability and ability to sell the product. So the issue really then is that fair? And the courts, there's nothing in Daystar that says anything about that, but the courts are legion that under reverse...
Is there some clause of federal law that just says, just ask whether that's fair? What federal statute is that?
Well, Your Honor, there is a fairness element of the Lanham Act, but there have been cases...
What federal statute are you relying on for this proposition?
Section 43A. Section 43A talks about false designations of origin.
You wouldn't actually want to give me the citation to it, would you?
Section 43A? I think it's 15 U.S.C. Section 1127, I believe.
1127, okay.
Yeah. But Your Honor, so there's two classes that are really affected. I'm not saying that if you did it fairly and you could buy your components from your competitor, that would make it illegal. The fact is that is not the case. I'm sorry, it's 1125A. I said 1127A.
1125.
But that's not what happens here, and the cases are legion that is improper. And usually it's only a sample. I mean, would you expect on a regular basis that your competitor is going to sell you key components that are difficult to make in order to allow you to compete with them? And while I agree with the antitrust laws where you have companies with the market power or market position of a Ford that may create other antitrust issues, in the ordinary world, with most competitors, it doesn't. And an ordinary competitor isn't going to sell. Bradford never indicated that it would sell the Y-leg table or the Y-leg portions to Smith. And Smith made a sale. You're right, Your Honor. The DISD didn't complain because the DISD had no idea that they got these parts from a Bradford table. And for those reasons, they were disadvantaged. They did not make an informed decision. As it happened in this case, Smith, by the time it had to deliver the tables, was able to, I guess, get its act together, as they say, and either Mr. Fong or some other supplier was able to make the Y-leg part that they needed to make the table. But the fact of the matter is that before that time, they were unable to do so, and so they injured two parties. One, they caused the DISD to buy a product or agree to buy a product, not knowing that the manufacturer had not been able to make that product itself, but had to rely on a competitor's product in order to make it. And the record in this case isn't that they just bought a leg, but they bought six out of the seven pieces. The only thing that was done was to put on a tabletop. And that certainly is something that was to the disadvantage of the DISD. As things worked out, that's fine. But with regard to competitors, which is also one of the purposes of the Lanham Act, to protect competitors, the competitors in this case Bradford, lost because there was an unfair head start that was obtained by, and that's set forth in the Arrow case and a number of cases, which point out the disadvantage to the manufacturer, the honest manufacturer, is that the defendant gets an unfair head start by getting into commerce and selling a product before it is ready to do so. putting the customer at risk and taking advantage of the goodwill, reputation, and products of the competitor. And I think in all of these cases, whether it's one part or whatever, the issue is, would the manufacturer, does it really have a present ability to make the product? And if it's key components, the answer is no.
If it's, what if they arrive at the customer and they don't have a sample?
Right.
And the customer says, well, we have a Breadford table here. And he says, well, right. We can make that.
The point is, that's honest competition, Your Honor. That's exactly right. You bring in a Breadford table, say, I haven't made one yet, but I'm a darn good manufacturer, and I've been in this business, and I can make one just like it. And then you as the customer have to make a decision. Do I believe him or don't I believe him? Am I willing to take a risk or not? Different from, I come in, I made this, and I can make one for you just like it. And as it turns out, you didn't make it. And if you did make it, fine. That's honest competition, too. When all we're saying is Smith should have waited until it could bring in its own computer table. And all it really did was lose a sale to the DISD. Ultimately, it came into the market. Ultimately, it was able to get products not from Breadford. And it was key components. I agree. If we're talking about screws and nuts, let's forget about this. We're not in the ball game here. We're talking about key components. In this case, they took 6 of the 7 pieces, and they got into the market before they honestly should have, and they put the competitor at a disadvantage, and they put the DISD at a disadvantage.
Well, is it your view we have a complex product? Is that it? That this isn't a screw or
yes, even you know, as we said, either 6 or 7 pieces. But if you look at the record at 3988 to 391, and if you look at Mr. Wodick's testimony at 64, I believe to 68, he pointed out that, and the judge pointed out in his decision at 388 to 395, that this Y leg required a lot of welds. These tables are holding heavy computer equipment, and if the welds aren't done properly, then they're no good. In fact, the judge found that Mr. Fong couldn't make the product because the welds weren't proper, and that this was not just something you go into a hardware store and buy. I agree. At some level, you say, hey, I can get that anywhere. You know, the implication here is, one, when you get it from your competitor, already the light goes on. And secondly, what do you get from your competitor? And is it something, Your Honor, that is complex or difficult that would take you a considerable time to make yourself? And the unfair competition here is getting the head start by going to your competitor's product and not disclosing it to the customer. So there's really two people who are damaged here, both the customer because he's not making an informed decision, and the competitor because you're relying on their good faith, their goodwill, their investment in time and energy to make the product themselves or to make the component that's material. Well, I see my time is up. I'm going to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Junico.
I did want to say on the trade dress issue, we believe that there is a likelihood of confusion issue. I just want to make one point, and that is that the court assumed that there was trade dress here, and since there were exact lines of channels of distribution were exactly the same, that the court really had nothing to do but find likelihood of confusion. It would be like if I went into a grocery store with Allen's Cola and I made a shape of a Coca-Cola bottle, and what the defendant is saying is, well, we had our name on it. I say, if you go into a supermarket and I have Allen's Cola and Coca-Cola next to each other, and they both have the same shape, that there's a trade dress problem there. And whether or not I put the name on it, under the Lanham Act protects against
have
false...
Have you been in Walgreens recently?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's all violating the Lanham Act, I take it, on your view? Because they put their trademark products right next to other suppliers in similarly, if not identically, shaped packages with similar sounding names.
Your Honor, the question is whether that's trade
dress. You'll buy Sudafed, you'll find Wall Fed, right?
I know. And there's a question as to whether or not the trade dress, that is the product shape, has achieved trade dress status. What I'm saying is if the product has achieved trade dress status, like a Coca-Cola bottle, then there would be a likelihood of confusion as to source, sponsorship, or approval. Somebody may say Allen's Cola and Coca-Cola. They're certainly different, but maybe there's some association because I recognize this trade dress as belonging to this company. And in this case, the reason I say that, Your Honor, is that in this case, the court assumed there was trade dress and just looked at the likelihood of confusion issue. If I was taking a Coca-Cola bottle and selling Allen's fertilizer in a garden shop, then the question would be a likelihood of confusion, different channels of distribution, different products, different customers. But in this case, it's exactly the same products, and if the court assumed that there was trade dress, then the court had to determine that there was a likelihood of confusion. Now, Your Honor's point on Walmart is correct. There are some that may overstep the bounds. I mean, the fact that Walgreens is doing that is trying to trade on something, whether or not the public recognizes certain colors or shapes or names as trade dress is an issue. But in the issue here, the court assumed there was trade dress, and therefore it had to find likelihood of confusion because it was exactly the same product and exactly the same channels of distribution. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Unico. Mr. Menchaca, Ka.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Alex Menchaca on behalf of the Appellee Smith System. Smith does not argue for the general proposition that a sample or a component can never give rise to Lanham Act concerns. Smith is only arguing that the specific facts in this case found by the district court judge, Judge Grady in this case, cannot give rise to any of Bradford's causes of action, either under the Lanham Act or under state court. This case is about a table leg, a welded metal table leg, a fungible item that is undisputedly available from any of hundreds of sources. The most important finding of fact in this case was made by Judge Grady in his order of October 7, 2003. In that particular order, Judge Grady, and that's tab I to Bradford's opening brief, in that particular order, Judge Grady specifically stated that the Dallas Independent School District does not care what is the origin of the component parts on the Smith System sample table. Specifically, the judge stated the evidence at that hearing, and that was the hearing on liability in April and June of 2001, was quite clear that the district was indifferent to the source of the component parts. Bradford's argument to the contrary misinterprets the record. So that's based on the evidence at trial. As noted by the Supreme Court in Daystar, the words of the Lanham Act should not be stretched to cover matters that are typically of no consequence to purchasers. So on that single finding alone by Judge Grady, Bradford's claims are negated. But that order of October 7, 2003 also had another very interesting revealing acknowledgement. And in that order on page 5, Judge Grady acknowledges that earlier conclusions of misrepresentation and deceit were not based on evidence, but were merely assumed. The judge stated in that order at page 5, Bradford, Smith, and this court as well have assumed up to the time of the Daystar decision that Smith's use of a Bradford leg in the sample would constitute misrepresentation. And of course, that is exactly what we held. So what is the judge telling us by that acknowledgement? The judge is telling us that there was no evidence of misrepresentation or deceit, and by simply relying on that one fact that Smith used a Bradford leg on the Smith sample table, the judge assumed misrepresentations and deception. Based on that acknowledgement, the court went further and expressly vacated and reversed its earlier conclusion of misrepresentation when it stated in that same order, even if the sample table were considered the good that was sold to the district by Smith, there was no misrepresentation as to the origin of the sample. The judge made a finding of fact in his order of October 7, 2003, that Smith was the origin of the goods of the sample table here. So there are three findings of fact that the judge made in his order of October 7, 2003. The Dallas Independent School District did not care at all about the origin of the component parts on the Smith System sample table. Second, that the earlier conclusions of misrepresentation and deceit were not based on any evidence at all, but were merely assumed. And third, that there was no misrepresentation as to the origin of the sample. Smith was the origin of the sample. But taking a look at Bradford's briefs here, and Bradford didn't really have an opportunity to argue this well this morning, but all of its claims that it's arguing for are based on the court's earlier conclusions of misrepresentation and deceit that are now vacated and reversed by the district court. Bradford, in its papers, has not attempted to even demonstrate that those findings of fact in the October 7, 2003 order by the district court judge are clearly erroneous, has not attempted to marshal up any facts to demonstrate that the record clearly demonstrates that Judge Grady's findings of fact are wrong. Therefore, Redford has waived that argument, and those are the facts that are on appeal, the facts that Judge Grady found in his ruling of October 7, 2003. One important focus of the...
You keep describing these as findings of fact, but Judge Grady didn't hold a trial, did he?
Judge Grady did have a trial, and if I can go back to the first statement I read right out of Judge Grady's order, he said the evidence at that hearing...
An evidentiary hearing, yes. Do you think that supports... Well, what was the status of jury issues here?
There was no jury demand here. It was all bench trial.
So an evidentiary hearing would be the same thing then. Okay.
That's correct.
No jury demand, that would work.
That's correct. And one important focus of the party's briefs is the Supreme Court Daystar decision. The Supreme Court does not set forth any new law in Daystar. It simply provides additional guidance and an additional understanding for the scope of the Lanham Act. And here, it's against 15 U.S.C. section 1125A. In particular, the Supreme Court made two points in Daystar. The first is that the words of the Lanham Act should not be stretched to cover matters that are typically of no consequence to purchasers. If people don't care about the source, then the Lanham Act doesn't apply. And that's just standard Lanham Act law. The next point that the Supreme Court made in Daystar was addressing the phrase origin of goods as it appears in the Lanham Act. And the Supreme Court, again, simply clarified that the term origin of goods is meant to refer to the producer of the tangible goods sold or offered for sale in the marketplace. Again, that's just standard black-letter Lanham Act law. And so the Supreme Court didn't set out new rules. It just simply provided additional guidance and understanding.
What was the representation as to who produced this table when it was shown?
There's no evidence as to whether there was any representations or misrepresentations at all.
Well, just the very act of presenting it is a representation, right? You didn't say you found it on the curb. You brought it with you.
Well, the very act of presenting it is a statement. This is what the tables that you are purchasing
are going
to... This
is my table.
I'm sorry?
It's my table, right? I brought it to this meeting. It's mine, right?
Well, that's not necessarily the representation.
What is the representation that was made? What does the record reflect as to what the representation was as the table? If any. I don't know what... it's an implied representation, I guess.
It's right. There is nothing in the record as to a representation that was made. In fact, the purpose for the sample is to bring it in so that the district... Dallas Independent School District will understand what the tables that it ultimately will be purchasing are going to look like. There's no evidence of any representations here, and that's a good point, because if Redford wanted to demonstrate some misrepresentations, it's Redford's burden to adduce some evidence as to representations, misrepresentations, implied misrepresentations. There's nothing in the record. And as we saw from the judge's October 7, 2003 ruling, the judge assumed those misrepresentations, not based on evidence, but based on the...
Why do you assume the judge assumed?
Because the judge...
What did Judge Grady... What led him to that now reversed assumption?
Well, in April and June of 2001, the parties had this hearing, this trial on liability. At the conclusion of that trial, the judge said, I am making this finding a fact. I have found that Smith has used a Redford table leg on its sample table. Now, excuse me, to you, Redford, I am inviting you to file whatever motions you feel are necessary to take that finding of fact and support any of your causes of action. And Redford specifically said, no, Your Honor, based on that single finding of fact, we believe that you can enter a finding of liability for reverse passing off. And the judge bought it. The judge said, okay, I agree with you, Redford, and then continued on and assumed that there were some misrepresentations that were involved in the single fact. But what happens here is that every cause of action has more than one element. Now, the fact that Smith used a Redford table on a leg, I mean, on a Redford leg on its sample table might satisfy one element of the cause of action of reverse passing off. But there are other elements to that cause of action. And you can't simply assume them. If misrepresentation is one of the other elements, you can't simply assume all the other elements based on establishing one element of the cause of action. But I was discussing Daystar and how does Daystar impact this case here? Well, Daystar, what it did is provided the district court an opportunity to revisit its earlier finding of reverse passing off and conclusions of misrepresentation and deceit based on the additional guidance and understanding provided by the Supreme Court. And with that additional guidance and understanding, the district court was able to see that its earlier finding of reverse passing off was an error, and its earlier conclusions of misrepresentation and deceit were also an error. Well, now turning to the causes of action that Redford has asserted under the Lanham Act. It's asserted a cause of action for reverse passing off. It's asserted a cause of action for trade dress infringement. And now, for the very first time on appeal, it's asserted a cause of action for implied passing off. This is a claim, this implied passing off is a claim that was expressly disavowed before the district court. It was never argued before the district court. And this court has stated in Web Printing that reverse passing off occurs when a person removes or obliterates the original trademark without authorization before reselling the goods produced by someone else. Also in Web Printing, which is 906 F. Second 1202, this court has stated that there's a likelihood of confusion that must result from that conduct. So in order for Redford to prevail on its claim of reverse passing off, Redford must show four things. Redford must show that it is the origin of the Smith System sample, that Smith obliterated Redford's mark from the Smith System sample, that Smith sold or offered for sale that sample, and that a likelihood of confusion resulted from this conduct. And the district court weighed in on three of those four elements. Specifically, the district court found it was a finding of fact, again, in its October 7, 2003 ruling, that the Smith System table was not sold and was not offered for sale. That's that's another finding of fact out of that October 7, 2003 ruling. The evidence supports that finding. The sample table was brought to the administrative offices of the Dallas Independent School District, where it remained. It was not in use. And then when Smith needed to retrieve it, it retrieved it. There was never any evidence that that table was sold or offered for sale. Next, the district court found that even if the sample could be considered the goods offered for sale, Smith and not Redford was the origin of that table. And that, again, is a finding out of the October 7, 2003 decision from the district court. Smith has not challenged that finding by saying that it was clearly erroneous. I'm sorry, Redford has not challenged that finding by saying it was clearly erroneous. Redford has not sought to establish that the facts in the record demonstrate that the judge's finding that Smith was the origin of the sample table was clearly wrong. And so Redford has waived that argument as well. Next, there is no evidence that Smith removed or obliterated Redford's mark from the Y-legs or from any Redford table. In its brief, Redford argues that some conduct in 1999 showing that Redford delivered tables in boxes that included the Redford trademark on the boxes could somehow constitute evidence as to what happened in 1997 when Smith acquired the Redford table. You can't take evidence from one time period, 1999, and apply it to try to show some element of your cause of action 2 years earlier, in 1997. There is no evidence as to what happened in 1997. It may be or it may not be that Redford's trademark was on the boxes, but
What if you had bought a Redford table and not changed the box, not changed the top? And but the only labeling that Redford has is on the box. And you leave that in the parking lot, you just bring the table in, but the table doesn't carry any identification. That wouldn't be you wouldn't be passing it off there, would you? Would you be obliterating the mark by leaving the box in the parking lot bring just the table the way you bought it, and saying this is what we make.
I think that there's a viable argument you can make that that is obliteration, but that's not the facts here. The obliteration.
Well, you must have done something with the box. Didn't you get it in a box originally?
Well, we did get it in a box, and we removed it from a box, but there's no evidence that that box had a Bretford mark on it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And so in 1999, perhaps, the boxes were labeled, but there's no evidence that in 1997 the boxes were labeled. Additionally, Bretford, this is the first time Bretford is making this argument about obliteration. In the district court, Bretford said Smith had obliterated the mark from the table itself, and the evidence that was adduced at trial was to the opposite. Finally, the district court specifically held as a matter of law that there can be no likelihood of confusion in connection with this particular industry with the way that these products are sold. The manufacturers work with dealers who work with the institutional customers, such as the Dallas Independent School District. The name of the manufacturer is on the contracts, on the bid. It's on all the documents. If a purchaser is interested in finding out who is the manufacturer, it's very easily available and readily available to it. Now, so there are no specific facts here that support any cause of action for reverse passing off. Now, for the first time on appeal, Bretford raises its claim of implied passing off. In the district court, Bretford expressly disavowed this claim. Not long after the court made its erroneous finding of reverse passing off, Smith queried whether Bretford's correct claim should be implied passing off. In response, Bretford vehemently and expressly stated, "Our claim is for reverse passing off and not for implied passing off." And so it has disavowed that claim. But even further, Bretford never made these arguments in the district court, and therefore it has waived these arguments. But even if Bretford is allowed to raise this issue for the first time on appeal, the facts don't support any claim of implied passing off. To find implied passing off, or to prove implied passing off, Bretford must prove, again, that Smith obliterated or removed a Bretford mark from a Bretford product, that Smith used a Bretford product to solicit sales, that Smith falsely represented that it was the origin of that Bretford product, that the customers were deceived or likely to be deceived, and that Bretford sustained some sort of damage from this conduct. And we've already gone through a bunch of these, but I'll briefly hit on them again. The obliteration, you can't take facts from 1999 and apply them to 1997. On the prong of whether Smith used a Bretford product to solicit sales, the district court expressly found that the sample table was a Smith table, and it was the origin was Smith, not Bretford, and so Bretford cannot prove that element of that cause of action. The other two, false representations and that customers were deceived or likely to be deceived, again, the district court reversed its earlier conclusions of misrepresentation and deceit, stating there was no evidence for these. We had merely assumed those. And so Bretford's reliance on those earlier vacated conclusions of misrepresentation and deceit will not support its cause of action for implied passing off. And finally, Bretford can't show that it's been damaged by Smith's displaying of a sample table that originated with Smith. Now, also, Bretford, for the first time on appeal, argues that, well, it doesn't really know what to call its cause of action. It lists 7 or 8 different names that it could call its cause of action, but it says we don't know. It could be reverse passing off, it could be implied passing off, or it could be false designation of origin, or it could be unfair competition, or unfair and deceptive trade practices, or false ad. We don't really know what our claim is, but we think that something here smells bad. We think that what smells bad is that Smith got some sort of head start, that when Smith displayed that sample table with the Bretford leg, Smith was making the implied misrepresentation that here's this table with this leg and we can reproduce it, even though really we, Smith, cannot reproduce it. Well, there's absolutely no evidence in the record to support a finding that Smith could not reproduce the tables. In fact, the evidence is to the contrary. The evidence is that there are hundreds of metal fabricating shops in the United States that can make these types of Y-legs and can make the tubes that are used to make these Y-legs. In fact, at the liability trial in 2001, Bretford's own witness stated that they obtained the tubes to make their Y-legs from third-party vendors. They stated that there are companies that just make these tubes, and we get them from there. But I see that my time.
Well, Bradford, though, was through the 90s, weren't they the bulk of the 90s, the only one making that configuration?
That's true. They were the only one making that configuration. And so I'll go to the trade dress infringement aspect, because I think that that's what your question is more directed to. And the district court, in its opinion, in the summary judgment order, saying there was no likelihood of confusion, also expressly stated, Bradford has failed to demonstrate any evidence from which we could conclude that there was secondary meaning here. And because it's a trade dress case, in order, under the Walmart Supreme Court decision, in order for a product configuration to be accorded trade dress rights, you have to show secondary meaning. The district court specifically said Bradford has failed to demonstrate secondary meaning. And furthermore, this Y-leg itself is merely functional. So taking a look at the Supreme Court's Traffics case, I see my time is up, Your Honor.
You can conclude that thought.
Okay. Taking a look at the Supreme Court's Traffics case, it's clear that the Y-legs here are merely functional and that there's no basis for trade dress rights here. In conclusion, Your Honor, I would ask that the court affirm the district court's final judgment in its entirety.
Mr. Unico, regrettably, your time had been expired. We asked you several questions, so you may have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
There was clear evidence of misrepresentation here. The court found at transcript 396-151-8, that's in tab C, someone in the employ of Smith, in my opinion, did misrepresent the origin of the table legs on the Dallas School District sample. Also, in App O, the actual bid that was submitted by Smith said this is a Smith brand table. They didn't just bring it in. They made an affirmative representation that it was a Smith brand table. And they didn't say this is just a table like one we could make.
So what do we have? Clearly erroneous findings by a district court?
No, actually, let me just say this. The district court also said, as we found the conclusion, Smith is liable on this basis for conduct of whatever agents passed off the Bradford legs as Smith legs. The court made findings, and there really was no dispute as to the findings. What happened was, after the Daystar decision was brought to the judge's attention, he made a number of legal conclusions based on those same findings. He said, well, if goods only means a complete table, then because I found they only misrepresented the table legs, then there can't be a misrepresentation as to goods. So all of these things that they've just said to you are a bunch of legal conclusions that the judge reached on undisputed facts. The facts are, as we said, I'm not going to go into them. I know we've only got a minute or two. But the fact that the judge decided that originally goods can include components and therefore was a misrepresentation, he only changed his legal conclusion that it wasn't because now, according to him, Daystar said components can't be goods. And that's the vice of this discussion of that they've made all of this. All of these are legal conclusions that the judge made. His findings were really undisputed. I see my time is up, but it still gets to this question of whether a sample is part of a sales solicitation. Their discussion about the judge called it a sample. Again, he never said it was something they just brought in to show them. They demanded a sample, and the reason they demanded it, as goes to Judge Easterbrook's question, they wanted to make sure that the company that they were buying from could make the quality of the product. And what they got instead was a product that they had to rely on their competitor to make. Mr. Fong couldn't make it. That's why they used our legs. Thank you.
Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the